Now stay tuned for Straight Talk.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC-FM. We are the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Andre Hakes, and you are listening to Straight Talk. My guest this morning is Nick Winner, Associate Professor of Politics at The University and co-director of the Power, Violence, and Inequality Collective at the University of Virginia. How are you doing this morning, Nick?
I am doing all right. Thanks so much.
I know you. You're a friend of mine. Your wife and I went to school together at The University, in fact. So it seems a little odd to ask you this, but Nick, tell me about your background.
Absolutely. So as you said, I'm a faculty member in the politics department at UVA, and I study political psychology. So I'm interested in how people make sense of politics or don't make sense of politics, and particularly interested in what psychology can tell us about how they think about politics and how politics intersects with what's going on in our heads.
What's your background? Where'd you go to school?
I got my PhD at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
Whoa, what? The? No. A university.
A university, yes. Actually, our friends to the south at Ohio State make a big deal about being the Ohio State University.
Is that right?
We're more secure up in Michigan.
Okay,
so
right.
We're just U of M.
Yeah.
And then I worked for a little while before graduate school in campaign politics in D.C. I worked for a small consulting firm, and so we worked for Democratic candidates.
Campaign politics. Wow,
yes.
What'd you do?
We basically wrote campaign plans. So we would look at the polling, we'd look at the electoral history, we'd look at the talk to the candidate and their team, and develop a strategy for, you know, who's going to vote for this person and why.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1992, we actually had the good fortune to work for both Barbara Boxer and Patty Murray, who
Woo-hoo!
Went on to be female senators from California and Washington, respectively. And so we like to think of ourselves as single-handedly doubling the number of women in the U.S. Senate.
Hey, I'm loving that.
Yeah.
It's a good marketing tip for that group. So I know you had a long conversation with my producer, Olivia August, before this show.
Yes.
Because she sent me a lovely packet of notes about all the things you might want to talk about. But the first one that sparks my interest the most is this idea of implicit cognition.
Yes.
Tell me what implicit cognition is, first of all, and then give me some examples of it.
Absolutely. So implicit cognition is really, in many ways, similar to what back in the Freudian days they would call unconscious unconscious cognition. And the idea is that our brains are doing quite a bit, only a small, tiny fraction of which is our conscious thought that we're aware of and have active control over.
Mm-hmm.
And one measure of that is this is a little hard to estimate, but the estimates are, if you think about all the sensory input that we are taking in at any moment, you know, the number of pixels that we see, what we hear, what we feel, taste, smell, all of that, that our conscious mind is able to attend consciously to about 1 in 1 million of that information. So there's
okay.
a lot going on there. And we're not just discarding the stuff we don't attend to consciously, but other parts of our brain that we're not aware of are tracking that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an elaborate system that alerts us when there's something out there we need to pay attention to. So this is why we can drive home one day, get home, and think, wait, I don't remember driving home at all.
Right.
I hope I didn't run over somebody.
This is why sometimes you find yourself on the road and you go, where am I on my drive? Oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
Exactly. Or you might drive to work because you got on the highway, even though you intended to go somewhere else, because that's where you tend to go. And you just were on autopilot.
Right. This is the turn I always take.
Exactly. Our minds will alert us when there's something unusual or unexpected. So that's why if you're at a cocktail party and there's a lot of murmuring of discussion around you that you're not paying attention to, but then someone says your name, that will catch your ear. And
right.
you'll hear it and you'll attend. So that's why, you know, when you get home and don't remember the drive, you can be pretty sure you didn't run over somebody because that would have caught your ear.
You would have noticed if you'd run over someone.
Exactly.
Yes, I see. Well, you like to think so anyway.
Right. So there's all this stuff going on, all this processing, and the implicit part of our brain doesn't just take in sensory input, but it does things with it. And the implicit part of our brain is actually really good at parallel processing of lots of information. What it doesn't do is logical thought, right? It's associational. So this, we associate it with that. That'll kind of bring it to mind. It'll be in there. It'll make connections. But it doesn't think through if-then sort of logical thought. That's what our conscious brains do.
Now, when you say parallel processing, what do you mean by that?
I mean, so our conscious thought, it's hard to think about more than a handful of things at once. The idea is you can remember about seven things. Mm-hmm. So it's probably, that's probably why phone numbers tend to be seven numbers long.
Mm-hmm.
Much beyond that, you've got to write them down. You've got to group them, something like that.
You have to have a mnemonic.
You need a mnemonic.
How does that idea of a mnemonic fit into this implicit cognition idea?
Well,
Does it connect up to that sort of loosey-goosey pool of associations in there and allow some of the resources?
Well,
so
the loosey-goosey associations are themselves structured, mm-hmm. and so they'll suggest to our conscious mind, or they'll suggest things, reactions, thoughts, feelings, emotions, and all the rest. And so I think one place that this really, we can see this happen, is when we're perceiving the world, we're doing it at two levels at once. There's this implicit set of operations going on that we're not aware of, but which are structuring what we see. And then, of course, we're consciously attending to whatever we're consciously attending to.
There's a law firm that I end up going to about once a month for the Kaaba Bar Association, mm-hmm. and the receptionist there is so sweet. She's so nice to me, and I can never remember her name. And this last time when I went down there, I made an association in my mind. Her name is Gina, because my wife's best friend in childhood was Gina, and Gina's very nice, and so therefore this woman's very nice to me. Therefore, her name is Gina, right? And now I think I will remember her next bar meeting.
Yes, absolutely, and that's a good example of you can form an association so that when you see the one thing that brings something else to mind, that then reminds you, ah, yes, Gina. I have a bad habit of developing mnemonics for myself when I misremember something that, oh, yes, it's the opposite of what I think it should be.
Oh, no.
Which works until you start to learn what it really is, and then you mix yourself up.
No, that makes sense.
But one of my favorite, though perhaps disheartening, studies about the role of implicit cognition, and this is closer to your world of the law, is a study by a psychologist, Keith Payne, who looks at the way that when people are perceiving objects and trying to decide, is this a weapon or is this not a weapon, mm-hmm. right? So this is a choice or a decision that, we have to categorize things in our environment all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But a particularly important and high-stakes moment of categorization is, say, when a cop sees someone reaching into their pocket and pulling something out.
Right. Is this guy pulling out his wallet to show me his ID, or is he pulling out a gun to shoot me?
Exactly. And so that's a decision you need to make in the split second.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one feature of the implicit mind is that it works very quickly. So mm-hmm. it suggests answers to whatever you're trying to do very quickly. Your conscious mind is slower, mm-hmm. and so eventually it will catch up. So in a situation where you've got to decide, is that a weapon or is that not a weapon? Mm-hmm. And you've got a few minutes to really come to a conclusion. You may have an initial reaction, but you'll push past that, consider mm-hmm. all of the evidence, think through, look at it more carefully, and, you can usually be pretty accurate.
Mm-hmm.
When you need to decide very, very quickly, that quick implicit initial suggestion can, you can go with that, especially if you're primed to be sure to take action very quickly. And so here's where it gets interesting. The Keith Payne study they do a study where they flash very quickly pictures of either weapons
mm-hmm.
or ordinary household objects
mm-hmm.
and then ask people that they've just seen it very quickly, fast enough that it's not subliminal, so mm-hmm. you can see it, but not mm-hmm. long enough that you can really think about it
mm-hmm.
and ask people to identify that. Before showing either the household objects or the weapons, they flash a picture of a face.
Mm-hmm.
And that's either, you guessed it, a white face or a black face.
I see.
And so what they find is that when you have people make decisions quickly mm-hmm. about whether it's a weapon or not, if you've shown them a black face beforehand, they're quicker to identify weapons
mm-hmm.
than if you show them a white face. And their errors, they're more likely to mistakenly identify non-weapons as weapons. So, after a black face, but not after a white face.
If you show them a picture of a cell phone real quick, after you've shown them a picture of a white face, they will say not a weapon.
They're more likely. Right. This is all a shift in, you know, people don't suddenly think right. everything is a weapon or nothing is a weapon. Mm-hmm. But yes, it shifts. You see a white face. And whereas if you see a black face and then a cell phone, you're somewhat more likely to mistake that in the instant as a weapon.
Does that change with the race of the viewer?
So there's some controversy in this area, but the my take on the main thrust of this research is that what's going on here is we've got both, you know, people are more or less prejudiced, racially prejudiced. And part of that is intentional. We're aware of it. We know our feelings. We may or may not be willing to admit it, but, mm-hmm. you know, we're aware of those feelings. But we also all, even if we're egalitarian, live in a society that associates blackness with violence, blackness with weapons, and mm-hmm. all the rest
right.
all the time. And so we've all got the implicit associations that connect mm-hmm. blackness with weapons. Mm-hmm. And so that holds for white Americans, it holds for African Americans as well.
In other words, even when you have an African American subject who is identifying these images, statistically, they are also more likely to identify an object falsely as a weapon if you've shown them a black face prior.
Right, because we all have the baseline association. And really what distinguishes those who act on those and those who don't is this the tendency to override that implicit association.
How much time do you need to make that override? When you were describing this study earlier, you said, you know, if you have a few minutes to think about it, and I'm thinking you probably don't mean a few minutes.
No, I don't mean a few minutes. I really mean a second or two. Mm-hmm. And so when I believe in the pain study I'm talking about, and there are a lot of studies with this basic paradigm, but when you make people make the decision within half a second, mm-hmm. you see the effect of these implicit associations. When you give them a second or two, that gives them time for their conscious mind to sort of catch up. And, you know, people still make mistakes, but they're not systematically predicted by the faces they see beforehand.
I see. So we're not talking about a long period of thinking. We're talking about something that is almost subconscious. I mean, the picture, the identification of the picture is not subliminal. You can say what it is.
Right, right. You can say what it is, but even when you've been told you're going to see a face, don't. You know, that shouldn't bear mm-hmm. on your decision. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, the it implicit does. Mind sees a black face. All kinds of associations come up, including this cultural baseline association of blackness with violence, weapons.
What and do all you the think rest. That the legal system should take from that? I mean, what should police departments be taking from that?
That's an excellent question. There are a couple ways that we can combat this, right? So one is to decrease the degree to which an individual associates blackness with weapons. And so there's some evidence that we can, in fact, train our minds to have new associations. So just as you, and now, ironically, I've forgotten the...
Her name is Gina.
There we go, Gina, right? Like, you think of Gina, and you've got this elaborate mnemonic. You have forged new associations in your mind. Mm-hmm. So, too, we can... reduce the implicit association we have between black and violent by forging new associations. So there's some evidence that even putting a poster of Martin Luther King Jr. in your office and looking at it and thinking about it, exposing yourself to new associations to blackness can lessen the implicit association that's there to begin with.
All right. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPBC. I'm Andre Hakes, and my guest today is Nick Winter, who is an associate professor of politics at the University of Virginia. So, Nick, moving on from this, let's talk for a minute about body cameras.
Yes.
I understand there's one of the things that is a big topic in the news right now is do we need to have body cameras on all police officers? And the thought of this is, well, it'll catch these instances of police brutality. It'll show what really happened and sort of equalize the playing field. But you have some interesting thoughts on perspective in terms of those cameras.
Absolutely. I mean, I should say at the outset, I think body cameras are a good idea. And I think they can work in a couple of ways to decrease instances of police brutality, not least of which is the fact that a cop with a body camera knows that he or she has a body camera. And, mm-hmm. you know, knowing that you're accountable for your actions will lead you to think about what you do in different ways.
So, knowing that you're being watched, you're likely to not be committing acts that would bring problems down upon yourself.
Exactly. And being watched, I mean, again, this operates both consciously and unconsciously. Mm-hmm. So there's a fascinating study where some psychologists put out a next to a communal coffee pot in their department, put out a basket to collect donations for the coffee. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people, surprise, surprise, tended not to donate very much. Mm-hmm. The surprising result was when they put up a face with eyes looking, just a picture mm-hmm. of eyes looking at you as you get your coffee, donations went up.
Really?
So this subliminal sense that you're being watched really does kind of shift how you think about the situation.
Well, that's kind of Orwellian. I mean, that's really kind of scary.
It is. It's absolutely. But what I think, the thing that I think we need to think of even more about body cameras, so stipulating they're probably very useful and achieve some of what we want. But the concern, I think, is that when we have video evidence or videotape of anything, we tend to think that that is a complete and an objective picture, literally, of what happened. That if you look at the videotape, then there can be no question about what actually happened
in a
situation.
I mean, why isn't it?
Yeah. Right. So there are a series of really fascinating studies, and these come not from body cameras directly, but from videotapes of police interrogations. Mm-hmm. So it's a similar context in some ways. And these started to be done when videotaping of interrogations first came into vogue in mm-hmm. the 80s and 90s, I think. And the idea there was, you know, then if we have a videotape of an interrogation, we'll know, was this coerced? Mm-hmm. Was mm-hmm. the person confessing being or being interrogated being mm-hmm. honest? If they confessed, was it an honest confession? And so on. Mm-hmm. And so what's fascinating is if you videotape an interrogation from the point of view of the interrogator, so with the camera focused on the suspect, mm-hmm. which is, I understand in the American context, that's kind of the norm, is that we, you know, we want to see the suspect because we want to be able to see, you know, their face and do they seem honest and are they fidgeting and so on.
Well, in the videos I've seen.
Yes.
And I have seen a lot of them.
I was going to say, you have seen more than I.
In both Albemarle and Charlottesville, what usually happens is there are a number of cameras in the interrogation room that show different perspectives. So there might be five or six cameras in that room and five or six different angles. Now, if the prosecutor elects to show the video, he's probably going to show the one that shows the face of the defendant. But in some of these angles, you sometimes get
a little bit of the interrogator, or both at once. And so what these studies show is that in the identical interrogation, if we've got a camera of just the suspect and we've got a camera of just the interrogator, mm-hmm. people rate if they just see the suspect, they are more inclined to believe that the interrogation was not coercive. Mm-hmm. They're more inclined to believe if there's a confession that it was honest, mm-hmm. that it wasn't coerced, that mm-hmm. it was believable, and so on. Mm-hmm. If, on the other hand, people or jurors see just the officer, mm-hmm. they're more likely to find the interrogation coercive. They're more likely to find a confession as, you know, maybe less believable, mm-hmm. you know, maybe due to the situation or to, you know, being pressured and so forth.
What kind of percentages would you put on that? What's the spread there, Nick?
Well, it's hard to say because it's one thing to bring people into a psychological laboratory and show them this videotape and have them rate it. it's another thing to sit in the context of a trial. That said,
well, I just meant in the experiments, if they did this, if they had the same interrogation, I assume the way they set these things up, they would have the same interrogation.
Right.
It would be a, you know, play acted maybe.
Yes.
And then they would
yes.
have a camera on the suspect and a camera on the cop. And then they'd show the interrogation to two different groups of people.
Yep.
One of them would see this camera. One of them would see the other camera. What's the difference in terms? What's the statistical kind of spread between those groups? I understand it's more likely, but how much more likely?
Yeah, I want to say, and I, you know, I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but I'm going to say it would move, 10-20%. So
well,
you know, you might get 50%.
It's significant
saying,
in a close case.
Yes, absolutely. So this is enough that it can matter. Especially in an ambiguous situation. And it's in ambiguous situations where these other cues can shape our impressions, even if we're not aware that they're shaping them.
So how do you think this might play out with the body cameras?
So with body cameras, imagine there's a situation. So body cameras, the perspective is going to be the perspective of the cop, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's on them facing out. And so in that case, we'll see the interaction literally from the point of view of the officer.
Mm-hmm.
And what these studies suggest is that when we view something from the point of view of a particular actor, we take on, to some extent, the position of that actor in a broader sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's a power relationship, we sort of feel a little bit, we have empathy, we
mm-hmm.
feel
mm-hmm.
a little bit. We take the position in a way that cognitively is almost literal of the person we're seeing.
We adopt the perspective we are shown.
Exactly.
So what does this mean? Does this mean that, like, you know, all black males within a certain age range should wear cameras around their necks?
This
is a self-defense. I mean, you know.
It does suggest that. There's the potential for a systematic difference in what we see when it's a body camera versus when it's a bystander with a cell phone
mm-hmm.
versus, you know, if,
mm-hmm.
No, I mean, obviously I don't literally think we should all wear body cameras for self protection, but there is something to this idea that what formally ought to be extraneous information, the literal visual perspective, in fact, colors what we see.
Right.
And that holds up even when people are told in, you know, mock juries that they're going to have to explain their decision. So the idea is we do this to try to get them to really think carefully and not just kind of go with their gut reaction. This holds up even in mock juries where judges give the jury instructions about this finding. That makes the effect get smaller.
I cannot
but it doesn't
imagine
make it go
actually
away.
Getting a jury instruction on this
well,
in Virginia. I mean, I just cannot imagine. I may think the judge would just laugh at me.
Probably.
I have a hard enough time getting the eyewitness instruction, and we know what some of the issues are with that.
So. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. But there was a fascinating study of this camera perspective that had a little bit more reality to it in Sweden. So back apparently in, I think, 2003, there was a high profile. You know this
mm-mm.
case. Someone was murdered in the street. Not murdered. Assaulted with a gun in the street, I think in Stockholm, by a masked person.
Mm-hmm.
Said that they thought they recognized their assailant as mm-hmm. their business partner.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds like one of these Girl with the Dragon Tattoo story, you know,
right, okay.
like something out of that. And so that person was convicted. And then a couple of years later, someone came forward and came to the media and said, I did this, and confessed. And there was a long videotaped question and answer with this confessee who then, claimed to have done it. Nobody really knows. You know, we don't know for a fact whether this was true or not. But that long interview was videotaped from several perspectives. And this sort of paradigm of showing people one perspective or another perspective, people found this person confessing to this crime to be noticeably more believable. And here's where the percentages are: about 20% more believable when they're looking at that person than when they're looking at the interviewer. So it's just a case of, you know, an actual crime and a real question. And
although that sort of changes the paradigm from, you know, looking at it from the perspective you're, you know, that you're watching. If you're looking at the person who's giving you these statements, then you find them more credible.
Well, and so I think in the case, yes, in the case of you find them more credible or you find whatever it is they're saying more believable, where when you're looking at the cop, you think, oh, they may have coerced this. Maybe we shouldn't take it
face
value.
Why would this person have done this? Why would this person have come forward? And then
who knows? And, you know, my knowledge of Swedish true crime is, you know, thus ends my knowledge of Swedish true crime. But the mechanism on this seems to be, at least in part, that we have a bias toward believing that the things we're seeing are causing what's happening. So we're watching the person say something, and at a subliminal level, when we see someone do something, even speak, we attribute the cause of that to the thing we see, which is them. And so when we look at the person questioning them, we're slightly more apt to attribute the cause of what we're hearing to the person that we're seeing, in that case, the interviewer or the interrogator.
No, that makes sense. When I asked you earlier about what things police departments should take from this research in terms of if you wanted to sort of change the way you did things, you said a couple of things. And one of the things you said was creating new associations. New associations with blackness, for example.
Right.
Was there something else that you were thinking that they might want to
Yeah, I mean, I think and the creating new associations for blackness is something, you know, not just cops should be engaged in, but we all should, even those of us who genuinely hold anti-racist egalitarian beliefs. We should recognize, you know, we watch the same media. We watch the same news mm-hmm. that, you know, is more likely to show perp walks for suspects of color and so forth. So we all can engage in that. The other thing that seems to matter, and this is more specific to the case of cops and guns and deciding about weapons and so forth, is expertise matters, right? So when we do something a lot, when we're trained in something a lot, we get better at it. And this is, again, you know, this is in all aspects of our life. When we practice, we get better. And so systematically learning about and practicing and engaging in training about making those split-second decisions, you get better at it. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, we all want to eliminate negative associations, but we also can, you know, in this case, get better at more quickly having other associations to more fine details, you know, so that exactly bits of information about the shape that we see, you know, for someone who does this day mm-hmm, in and day mm-hmm, out, mm-hmm. that will cue very quick associations.
You know what that makes me think of? That makes me think of certain video games, certain first-person shooter video games. You're the guy with the gun, you're the good guy, right? And the bad guys, you have to shoot all the bad guys. And some of these video games every so often will throw a hostage in or someone who's not the bad guy, right? And you're not supposed to shoot them. And it's hard not to do it because you are shooting everything you see.
And your behavioral posture and you're primed to shoot. You're, mm-hmm. you're, you know, at both an explicit level and an implicit level, you've put your brain in the mode of, I see something pop up, I shoot at
it. I shoot it, right.
And you've got to then, and so at the higher levels when they start putting the hostages and the baby carriages and the whatever, you've got to change your behavioral stance from, if it moves, I shoot it,
right,
to I need to evaluate very quickly. And those games get easier as you do it more and more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you start to be able to more quickly recognize, oh, hostage, oh, non-hostage. So practice is important. Of course, being more deliberate about your decision making is the best solution. But in the case where, you know, if someone pulls a gun, your time will expire very quickly. You know, that's not a realistic solution to say, well, we should just be deliberate about every decision.
I understand. You are listening to Straight Talk on 94.7, and we'll be back in just a moment.
On Wake Up Call this Sunday, attorneys Greg Pooper and Will Cleveland from the Southern Environmental Law Center will join host Rick Moore in the studio to discuss the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, designed to run through national forests and local counties. They'll also talk about Dominion's Brimo Power Plant in Fluvanna, recently approved to dump toxic coal ash into the James River. This is the Wake Up Call with Rick Moore. Tomorrow at 11, brought to you by Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
So, this is Andre Hakes on Straight Talk, 94.7 WPVC. My guest today is Nick Winter, who is an associate professor of politics at the University of Virginia. Nick, so tell me a little bit about benevolent sexism. What is benevolent sexism?
Well, it sounds like an oxymoron.
I saw that in my notes, and I was like, benevolent sexism?
I don't know. Well, so to back up, I think the idea we have when, you know, we hear the word sexism, we think of it as, you know, kind of straight up old school hostility toward women.
Mm-hmm.
And very much on analogy with racism as hostility toward African Americans, mm-hmm. or toward, you know, the other. And several scholars have suggested that gender stereotypes and sexism are a little more complicated than that. So there certainly is a face of what we might call hostile sexism, which is that traditional just antipathy toward women. But on the other hand, there's a set of beliefs that at least on their face are positive and warm toward women, that, you know, put women on a pedestal, that believe that women are particularly pure and virtuous and all the rest.
I feel myself getting kind of pure and virtuous.
I know. It's so wonderful.
I think it's called paternalism.
Exactly. This also gets called paternalistic sexism.
Mm-hmm.
And the argument is that this is sexism not because it involves outright hostility, but because it is it constrains women to take particular roles and act in certain ways and to take particular roles that, not coincidentally, have less power, right?
And well-behaved women rarely make history.
Exactly, right? And so the choice that this, if in a society that it has a combination of hostile sexism and benevolent sexism, the interesting thing is people who tend to be more hostily sexist also tend to be more benevolently sexist. So they hold these ambivalent views toward women that are both hostile on the one hand, but also, superficially at least, warm and positive on the other.
You mean the guy who's a real misogynist is more likely to open the door for you?
Exactly.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the correlation here?
There are correlations of, I would say, in the sort of point... Well, okay, so the correlation coefficient is between 0.3 and 0.5,
right,
which in the world of social attitudes, that's pretty big. And so the argument is... So the question is, how is it that someone can hold both positive and negative, both warm and cold views at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
And the way that works at the individual level is by subtyping. So we don't have just stereotypes of women, right? But someone who is both hostile sexist and benevolently sexist has stereotypes about different kinds of women.
Oh, good girls and bad
good
girls.
Good girls, Madonnas and whores. Exactly.
Oh, no.
Right. And so hostile sexism is directed at the bad girls, at mm-hmm. the women who don't live up to the expectations of purity and virtue.
You mean people who aren't pure and virtuous like me.
Exactly.
Right.
On the other hand, so benevolent sexism is directed toward those, you know, mom, sister,
mm-hmm.
wife, virgin.
Make the cookies.
Who make the cookies.
Barbara Bush is making the cookies in the kitchen.
Exactly.
Oh!
Exactly. And so so if you are a woman in a society that is characterized by this combination,
mm.
you've got this wonderful choice to either endure hostility for not constraining yourself to this particular vision of purity, or reap the rewards of this positive, you know, and the benefits of this warmth, but the price of that is to fit yourself into this particular
role. To be denied power.
Absolutely. Right.
Power puts you in the bad girl camp.
Absolutely. And it's violation of status relationships between men and women that particularly drives the switch from that good girl to the bad girl.
I know we are distinguishing in some ways sexism from racism in this discussion because we're talking about benevolent sexism, right? But I'm reading right now, I'm rereading Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, right? And so one of the things that I am seeing is there is a benevolent racism as well. I'm suddenly rereading this book and kind of going, oh my God, you know, there are people here who think they are old white people who think they're helping the Negro race in this book. This is the way it's put.
Yes.
You know, they're gonna help raise them up, and it's very patronizing. I mean, it's so I'm not sure there isn't the same thing there.
Absolutely, that's a really good point. And what seems to generate this mix of hostile and benevolent is social situations or social structures where the two sides or the two groups, men and women, white people, African Americans, where they're spatially together and functionally interrelated, right? Mm-hmm. So if you think about in a traditional heterosexual family, it doesn't work very well to be purely, as the husband, to be purely hostile toward your wife.
Right.
Right. You need your wife, in the sort of traditional heterosexual arrangement, men and women need each other. And so this, superficially at least, positive emotional benevolence comes from the functional interdependence between the two, where there's this reward of the positive emotion when they're intertwined with each other. And so there's historical evidence that particularly in the pre-Civil War South, and especially on plantations where enslaved people and white folks were both spatially integrated and functionally dependent on each other, that there were these exactly parallel ideologies of the paternalistic and benevolent role that the master plays to help or uplift. And if you're subservient and well-behaved, jiving and shucking and all the rest, then you're rewarded with this sort of superficial...
In Ellison, you get to go to the college, right? You get to live in this idyllic kind of place and, you know, sing hymns in the chapel, right? And there are trees and flowers and life is good, right?
Absolutely.
Outside the bounds, then you're hosed.
All is bad. Exactly. And, I mean, I tend to say, you know, superficially positive, but we shouldn't minimize the fact that there's actual real material benefits to this, and yet always at the price of power.
So maybe there are both kinds of racism and both kinds of sexism.
There are, and we should expect to see more of this benevolent face of an ism in cases where, again, the groups are more intertwined with each other. And so the prevalence and continuance of racial segregation in American housing, in the American workforce. Again, it's not complete. It's not the same as Jim Crow, but it has, you know, the housing segregation has by and large increased or stayed steady, means that white folks and black folks in America on average are much less functionally intertwined with each other than male folks and female folks are. And so we see more benevolent sexism than racism, which is not to say that we don't see some of both.
How do you think that this idea of implicit cognition plays out with these benevolent isms?
Interesting. I mean, I think, again, we have associations, we have reactions to stimuli that are based in part on our stereotypes, the category, right? And so the stereotype of the good woman or the bad woman shapes our emotional and cognitive reactions to some situation. And so there's a good bit of research on reactions to rape cases where what seems to... So people who are benevolently sexist are more likely to blame the victim of an acquaintance rape, but not more likely to blame the victim of a stranger rape.
Wow. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. And so the idea here is a stranger rape sort of fits a very unambiguous stereotype of, you know, it's harder in the case of a stranger rape, the, you know, man in the bushes who jumps out in the parking lot. And
it's kind of hard to figure how you blame the victim on that.
Exactly. Like, that's a pretty clear cut case. In acquaintance rape cases, and I'm sure you know better than I do from experience of dealing with these cases, it's much, you know, there's much more room to imagine that, you know, perhaps she had it coming in some way. Perhaps she didn't fit the pure, chaste guardian of morality role that the benevolent sexist mindset puts on women.
Right. She wore suggestive clothing, right? She had go-go boots on, therefore.
That's a clue that perhaps she's not entirely that in that category.
I wonder what would happen in these studies that you're talking about with the gun. If instead of just showing, you know, the gun or the you know, rolling pin, whatever, I don't know, or the other object, cell phone, I wonder if what would happen if instead of showing just a face before it, you drew back and showed some context around the face? I wonder if you would be able to show, you know, a particularly nicely dressed black man in a suit with a briefcase and a tie, or a nice elderly black grandma, you know, with her hair up in curlers, if you would get the same kind of statistical correlation as you would if you just show just a close-up of the face.
Right.
Or
I think that's a fascinating question. There's, you know, a hugely complex...
Or if you showed the white kid with a bunch of tattoos and piercings. And, you know, I mean, the guy's got, like, metal coming out of his lip like tusks. I wonder if you can, you know, if you get more often, you get the gun.
I imagine you would.
And you would, too.
And they're kind of, you know, I mean, so there are many things we associate with danger and with weapons, not just blackness on the one hand. And so... you know, as you say, someone who fits the description of our image of danger isn't there. There are many ways you can embody that. And on the other hand, there are, just as there are subtypes and stereotypes about types of women, so too there are stereotypes about types of black folks among whites in America. And so especially for people who have more developed and more differentiated stereotypes about African Americans, there's going to be a big difference between, as you say, the... And so we're really, I think, when we show a black face, what we're most likely cueing is stereotypes about, you know, young black men, young dark-skinned black men. Mm-hmm. And so... you know, if we change the age, if we change the context in other ways, you know, if it's an old African-American lady, you know, that's likely that we don't have as strong associations with, you know, weapons and danger.
I wonder, though, if some of these associations are happening subconsciously, I wonder how much, you know, if you're talking about that half a second.
Right.
How much of that might be... might still apply, and how
well,
much might not.
So when we perceive people, the first thing in terms of just within milliseconds, first we perceive their gender, then we perceive their race pretty quickly. Then
only gender first, then race?
Yeah, I mean, it's they're both, it's those two right away, and then
All
we
right,
move
wait a second,
from there.
Hold that thought, because I'm supposed to say at this point in time that you are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And I'm Audrey Hanks, and this is Straight Talk, and my guest is Nick Winter, who's a professor over at UVA. Okay, pick right back up where you were.
Right. So we very quickly, in perceiving a person, race and gender are the two first things that we perceive. And so initially, yes, we're going to cue, if it's a black face, regardless of what sort of black face, one of the first things that will come is that. And yet, we also very quickly are taking in, you know, in imagining a cop with someone pulling something out of their pocket, they are not simply looking at the person, they're taking in the whole situation. And so I think that broader context very quickly will continue to shape that. And depending, if you have a very well articulated sense of, you know, so in many movies, there's the sage older black man who comes down to enlighten the, you know, white folks, right? I mean, that's a stereotype that's a benevolent stereotype, racial stereotype. So someone who, you know, fits that sort of visually and behaviorally, fairly quickly, that stereotype might be cued. Now, whether that's, I don't know, and we there's certainly a possibility that in that first milliseconds of deciding, is this a weapon and I should start firing or not? I think that the racial stereotypes are going to come.
I wonder if you could parse it out, if you would find that, you know, in the first quarter second, it makes no difference, but at, you know, 0.6 seconds, it, you know, makes a difference. The age makes a difference.
Or yeah, I mean, there are psychologists who wire people's brains up and do, it's called event-related potentials, and, you know, you can see when different regions of the brain are getting electrical activity. And then you can have people make decisions with different time frames and sort of see at what point do these other things kick in. And you know, what as social perceivers, we're always engaged in first impressions, and then we update those insofar as we're motivated to and insofar as there is evidence that leads us to update that. And then eventually we kind of settle in on a final impression and act on that until that impression proves.
Well, what about Latinos? We're talking about black people and white people here, along with our good girls in bed. Talk to me about stereotypes involving Latinos in this country.
Well, so I will say that it is a flaw in the research on race in America that it is so overwhelmingly focused on black and white. So that's where a lot of the findings come from. And there, I mean, there are good reasons for that, given the history of race relations in the United States and the ways that the unique history of African Americans in the United States and the unique ways that race in black and white has been encoded in laws and all the rest. That said, you know, I think we have, we white folks have stereotypes about Latinos that are to some extent very parallel in a kind of us versus them. You know, there's an underlying current of us versus them.
Well, that, and they're more legitimized. I mean, look at Trump, right?
Right, right.
I mean, they're very legitimized.
Well, I mean, Trump is an interesting case where he is seems to be quite willing to explicitly state a whole range of stereotypical
all Latino
views.
Men are rapists? That struck me as kind of, you know, a little those, over the top.
Just a touch, right? You know, he's I'll go out on a limb and say Trump is, you know, known for a little overstatement here. But the standard line in political science on the use of race in campaigns until now, and I think it's still true to some extent, but was that Americans, white Americans, have these negative racial associations, but they also, by and large, though not not entirely, have genuinely held egalitarian views that say, you know, that's not how we should be thinking about politics.
Which is sort of, again, that logical conscious mind versus the unconscious,
absolutely,
implicit cognition mind.
Exactly. And so in that situation, the way for a white candidate potentially to mobilize to make use of race is not to say, as candidates might have in the 19th century, did in the 19th century, to say, you know, I will keep whites on top, but rather to implicitly cue racial ideas without talking and making explicit that that's what they're doing. And so the infamous Willie Horton ad back George Bush Sr.'s campaign against Michael Dukakis. There was an issue around Willie Horton, who was a convicted criminal in Massachusetts when Michael Dukakis was governor. He was let out on a furlough. He raped and killed some people and became the subject of a Dukakis' soft on crime ad. So this ad is purportedly about crime. This isn't a racial ad, but it did show a very stereotypical mugshot of this menacing black man who was this guy, William Horton. And the argument is, and studies seem to have shown, that when you show people this ad, they notice race. So race is made salient to the unconscious mind. But because race isn't mentioned explicitly, the ad says Dukakis is soft on crime, not Dukakis let this black man out. And let him.
Well, then how does Trump get away with what he's
well,
getting,
so
doing
that's
here?
The question.
I mean, what? There's nothing implicit about what he's saying.
He should be, according to the theory, he should be punished for being so explicit about this.
And yet.
He also should have faded long ago. And, you know, every pundit has, although the narrative has switched. The narrative has switched from he'll fade any day to he is inevitable, and this is the new Republican Party. I think the truth is somewhere in between. I do think the air will start to come out of the balloon as caucusing and voting begins, though I have to say I'm a little nervous saying that in public because I will, you know, join every other pundit in being wrong. But I think part of what's going on here, two things I think are going on.
What do you think
here.
The Trump voter looks like? Who are the people that are supporting this guy?
Right. Well, I think that's part of it is, who is Trump popular among? He's popular among likely Republican primary voters. That's a different population than the American public as a whole. And I think if Trump does end up being the nominee, or if he runs as an independent candidate, he will be hurt substantially among quite a bit of the public for many things, among them this these explicitly racist and racially charged statement.
So that's, maybe the primary system itself pushes everybody to the extremes. The people who are the most extreme on each side end up winning the primary because the likely primary voters are the extremists in the party.
Right.
And then when it comes to the general election, you end up with a runoff of the two far left and far right.
Right. At least there are forces that push that way. There are also forces that push back the other way, including the establishment parts of the party. Now, it's possible that the establishment part of the Republican Party is less strong than we all thought it was.
What about Trump opting out of the debate with the female moderator at Fox? What's the story with that?
Well, so I think Trump is...
Was that a good move or a bad move? I mean...
I thus ends my willingness to speculate on the effects of anything Trump does. But I will
say, come on, Nick.
I think, but here's what I think about Trump. I think he is himself what psychologists call an authoritarian. And so authoritarianism is this psychological predisposition that was really invented coming out of World War II as a way to explain, why is it that massive numbers of people in Germany and Italy followed these fascist leaders, right? And the argument about so authoritarianism is, it's not just a desire for authority or power. It's really a mindset that feels it's the opposite of egalitarianism. And so it's a belief that really social relations are best when they are hierarchical. And so an authoritarian is someone who believes that it's very important that there be people in charge and the right people, legitimate people in charge, and that those who aren't in charge submit to that legitimate authority. And that legitimate authority...
I thought that was called fascism.
Well, so in many ways, authoritarianism is the psychological substrate of... that would predispose one to be inclined toward fascism as a political ideology, right? And so for an authoritarian, legitimate authority is traditional authority. So that's male, that's white, that's middle class, and so on and so forth.
So we got a big daddy complex.
We've got a big daddy complex.
Big daddy complex. Let's elect this father figure?
This strong man who will come in and fix things, right? That things have gone topsy-turvy. We've got, you know, this black guy in charge, and that, you know, upends the natural order of things,
right?
And so what we need is someone who's going to cut through all the mumbo jumbo, cut through all the scheming and the conspiracies to get to what's real and true and put things back into their proper hierarchical arrangement. And so, you know, for Megyn Kelly to push Trump, right, for Trump
Being a bad girl, isn't
she?
She's being a bad girl when she asks him hard questions.
And so she should be punished. And it's you know, so I think there's a real feeling. So I think that is part of the root for Trump of what seems to be a real kind of real inability on his part to deal with her, and that, you know, and his tendency to, or his move to suggest that, you know, perhaps she was menstruating and that explains, you know, why she was acting in that way.
I wonder how he'll deal with Hillary.
You know, that would, as a political scientist, that would be fascinating to watch.
I hope we don't get to watch
citizen,
it.
As a citizen, I'm not sure I want to have to watch that. So, you know, I think that's what's going on for him. And I think that's a good part of his support comes from folks who are looking for that father figure who's going to cut through it all and make it right. And so I think walking away, it could cut either way. It could be a sign of, you know, he's not going to put up with this BS. He's going to do what he knows is right and damn the consequences. Or it could make him look not so strong, you know, that he's, you know, is he really not tough enough to, like, take it from, you know, this chick?
Right.
you know, and it really depends. And there it really depends on what his opponents do with it. Right. Because that's the thing about politics is when it works well, voters have reactions because have negative reactions to what candidates do because someone on the other side makes that argument that they can then endorse. And that's what we haven't seen is anyone really willing to take on Trump. We're starting to see that. But we'll just see.
Okay. Well, Nick, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed having you on the show.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
You are listening to 94.7 WPBC-FM, and this is Straight Talk with Andre Hakes. Y'all have a good weekend.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hayes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.